Hello and welcome to ALS Grab Radio, Season 2, Episode 3. I am your host, Seth Christensen, here with my co-host, Lori Wingsgard.
Welcome to the show. Throughout our discussion with Dr. Cox, if you have a question, please dial in at 516-590-0362 and then press 1 to indicate that you have a question, and we will get to you. Now, I would like to give a proper introduction to our guest. Dr. Paul Allen Cox is a Harvard PhD who has spent his career searching for new medicines by studying patterns of wellness and disease among Indigenous peoples. For these efforts, Time magazine named Cox one of the 11 heroes of medicine. His work with Indigenous peoples in preserving their island rainforests won him the Goldman Environmental Prize. Cox has published over 200 scientific papers and 4 books. He has held academic appointments at the University of California, Berkeley, Brigham Young University, the University of Melbourne, Uppsala University, the Swedish Agricultural University, and the University of Illinois, Chicago, and served as director of the congressionally chartered National Tropical Botanical Gardens in Hawaii and Florida. Cox founded Seacology, the world's premier environmental nonprofit organization for island conservation, headquartered in Berkeley, California. Through partnerships with Indigenous people, Seacology has now saved over 1.3 million acres of island rainforests and coral reefs in 56 nations. Throughout Polynesia, he is known by his chiefly title, Nafanau. Cox currently serves as the executive director of the Institute for Ethnomedicine in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. His research there is focused on finding and fighting the causes of neurodegenerative disease, including ALS and Alzheimer's disease. Welcome, Dr. Cox.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor to have you with us today, Dr. Cox. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule.
Well, of course, Seth. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you, like I said, and wondered, Lori went over a formal introduction, but we don't know from that bio how you came to study ALS. Could you share that with us?
Sure. I'm an ethnobotanist. My training is in how to work with Indigenous people to study their patterns of wellness and disease with an idea or an eye to coming up with new pharmaceutical treatments that can benefit people everywhere. I began in cancer research. Moved in the 1980s to HIV/AIDS, and that was a deeply moving experience to me. HIV/AIDS was a very different sort of disease in the 1980s than it is now. Many people were dying, and there seemed to be more than death, sort of a loss of them being treated as persons and being treated with the dignity and respect that all people deserve. And so I became very emotionally attached to the HIV/AIDS community for a while. I think I was only one of 2 straight members of the AIDS Research Alliance Board. And it was a deeply emotionally moving thing to me. We discovered a new drug candidate called Prostratin in my work with Indigenous people. And once that got launched down the pharmaceutical pipeline, I wanted to find another disease that I could work on that had the same sort of sense of hopelessness, maybe sense that there hadn't been any useful drugs discovered, maybe the possibility that a new approach, that new eyes could shake loose some new ideas. I'm also very willing to work on what I call high-risk research, meaning research that has only a very small chance of success and a high risk of failure. So I started thinking about different diseases and decided to study ALS. And so in the 90s, late 1990s, I quietly read everything I could find about ALS, tried to educate myself about the illness. I decided that I would start my research by studying indigenous people who had the highest rates of ALS in the world. And so with my colleagues, began very quietly in the late 1990s and early 2000s, taking expeditions to some remote villages in Guam where people suffered from an ALS-like disease at about a rate of 100 times what it occurs here. One of the villages we're in, about 25% of the people were dying of an ALS-type disease. And so I thought perhaps if I could figure out what was going on in that village, that it would give greater insights into ALS in general.
Wow. And over these years, has the field progressed, or have there been major milestones that propelled your research forward?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first objective was to try to understand what was happening in these villages. And I think that's a very different approach to the disease than traditional researchers. Only drug that's been approved by the FDA for the treatment of ALS is Riluzole, also marketed as Relutech. That was approved by the FDA in 1994, and I just really didn't see much coming out of the drug pipeline. A typical research program would be to develop a mouse model of the disease. And, of course, 1994 of the SOD1 mouse model. And then you screen a host of different pharmaceutical compounds against that model to see if you can improve the animal model of the disease. This was very different. We were dealing with people. It turned out there had not been prior ethnobotanical work of studies of these people, although there had been a lot of neurologists through the years that had become very interested in Guam. They were all clinicians. As an ethnobotanist, I'm trained to live with the indigenous people, to conform my lifestyle to their culture, to attempt to learn their language. And we like to think that people tell us things and we gain understands this way that would not be gained in a clinical setting. So I think the first milestone that we gained is one that we brought to the table because of my botanical training. We became very interested in a neurotoxin called BMAA. This had been isolated from the seeds of cycads. These are trees that the people use the seeds to make tortillas. They make flour out of the seeds and use it to thicken stews and make dumplings. And we found two things. First of all, we were very interested that the indigenous people eat flying foxes. These are very large bats. This had not turned up in any previous studies by medical researchers. And then we also found that they have specialized roots in these trees that harbor photosynthetic bacteria called cyanobacteria. So we cultured these roots in our laboratory, the cyanobacteria in them, found they produced this toxin, BMAA. We then looked at museum tissues of these flying foxes and found a very strong accumulation of BMAA in the flying fox tissues. So that was really sort of the first milestone, I guess, would be to confirm suspicion of previous researchers that this toxin, an environmental toxin, might play a role. But the this research came at some cost because we realized, really to our horror, that cyanobacteria just don't occur in this little island in Guam. They occur throughout the world. We got our colleagues around the world to send us laboratory samples of cyanobacteria isolated from lakes in New Zealand, the Baltic Ocean, the streams in Bermuda, everywhere. And we found that of 30 different types we sampled, I think it was 29, contained the toxin. So it was a bit frightening to me at the beginning to realize that people could be exposed to this toxin anywhere in the world. They wouldn't have to live in this village in Guam. These people in Guam got a very high dose, but you know, low-dose exposures might be different elsewhere. We then were very fortunate in being able to obtain autopsy tissues from Chamorro people in Guam who had died of this disease, ALS-like disease, and we found that all of them had high amounts of the toxin in their brains. This work was replicated and extended by the Miami Brain Bank, Dr. Deborah Mash, who found that in 13 out of 13 ALS patient brains she studied in Miami, that all 13 had significant amounts of this toxin, VMAA. So this did not prove that VMAA exposure could trigger an ALS, but it certainly encouraged us to continue the research.
Incredible. Some as a side question, are there other hotspots worldwide other than Guam for the
There are indeed. Yes, there are. There's a hotspot in a remote part of Japan called the Kii Peninsula. We've traveled there several times. We've been studying carefully the diet and lifestyle of these people. We have found BMAA in their food supplies and water supplies, but we're not quite ready to publish that. We have not yet confirmed BMAA in brain tissues of patients who are in Kii, so we're still working on that. There's another place in New Guinea that has a high rate of ALS. We would very much like to get there. It's been in a bit of a military area. And it's difficult, so it's been difficult for us to get permission to go there. The other thing that was quite interesting to me, I was fascinated, Seth, with reports of U.S. military personnel who had been deployed in the first Gulf War in 1992 to through 1993. About 10 years later, when they returned, many of them started experiencing ALS, and it was about 2 to 3 times the rate of soldiers that had been trained in the same way but not deployed to the Gulf. So together with ALS researcher Dr. Walter Bradley, who was chairman of the Department of Neurology at the University of Miami Medical School, we went to the Gulf. I thought this might be a way of disproving a hypothesis, because we typically think of cyanobacteria as the sort of blue-green scum that occurs on ponds or reservoirs and during warm weather. And here we're in a desert area. But we got in the cutter. I saw an unusual soil crust, poured my water on it. It immediately started photosynthesizing. We've since discovered that parts of the low-lying areas of the Gulf deserts are up to 87% are covered with cyanobacterial crust, which produced BMAA. So our hypothesis was that soldiers marching behind tanks going through the desert were inhaling aerosolized cyanobacteria and getting exposed to the toxin that way. The epidemiology is quite interesting. The ground troops indeed did experience this sort of sudden spike 10 years later of ALS. But so did helicopter pilot mechanics. And we were puzzled, why helicopter mechanics? Turns out that the helicopters in that first deployment could only fly 24 hours or so before their engines were clogged with dust. When they land, the helicopter mechanics were just covered with dust from the rotor blast and from ripping apart the engines. So we include U.S. military personnel now in our studies, and we've been very interested in the possibility that people could be exposed to the toxin either by inhaling dust from cyanobacteria in the deserts or by inhaling aerosolized cyanobacterially contaminated water from lakes and reservoirs, or by eating shellfish that have been contaminated with BMA. So we've been working very carefully trying to figure out what are the most likely exposure routes of people to these toxins. The picture that's emerging, Seth, is that we believe that at least some forms of ALS result from gene-environment interactions. They're an interaction between having a vulnerable genotype and then having exposure to this toxin, which serves as a trigger. So the BMA hypothesis is that the genotype is sort of like a gun and the environmental toxin is the trigger. So our focus, which is quite different from mainstream ALS research, is to try to find drugs that can block that trigger. And that's led us to our current investigations of the amino acid L-serine.
Thank you for that answer. We want to dig further into the unique approach of the Center for Ethnomedicine, but first we'll pause. Our listeners are listening both by phone and over the computer. For those who have a question for Dr. Cox, I'll have Lori tell you how to ask.
To ask a question, dial 516-590-0362 and press 1 to indicate that you have a question, and you will be on hold while you listen.
Thank you, Lori. Now, as you mentioned, you're a bit different in your approach from mainstream research. Lori mentioned that one of these things is that you are located not at a university, but we know you are associated with other researchers around the world. Could you tell us a little more about how the Center for Ethnomedicine works?
Sure, sure. And fortunately, we've just rebranded ourselves. We call ourselves now the Brain Chemistry Labs, because I think people are struggling trying to figure out what on earth ethnomedicine is. So we're the Brain Chemistry Labs at the Institute for Ethnomedicine in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. What I did when I started realizing that we had a lot of different interesting aspects of the story that was emerging, I felt that we needed to have an interdisciplinary global group of researchers all working together. I felt that no single discipline could succeed in trying to discover a new ALS drug. And so I've gone around the world to various researchers in different areas, including chemistry, neurology, synthetic chemistry, oceanography, and have asked them, you know, would you please, and I've cherry-picked the top minds in the world. So I said, you know, you're doing wonderful work now, but would you please stop and come join with me in trying to find a cure for ALS? And I tell them a little bit about our research, and to the person, they've always agreed. So we have 50 researchers now around the world in 28 different universities or government labs. I think we've got 12 or 13 countries represented. Everybody checks their egos at the door, because you may be good in neurology but not know a whole lot about oceanography. I mean, it's been sort of fun to see researchers share and help each other. One of my frustrations with drug research in general is that in the typical pharmaceutical model, the scientists are siloed up. They're not sharing information. And I've worked with now five or six pharmaceutical firms during my career, and you know, they're great research organizations, but you have to sign a pile of confidentiality agreements about you know, 6 inches thick, and I don't think that's a good way to find drugs, is to sequester information. Furthermore, I've been concerned about using the for-profit model as a mechanism of drug discovery. A lot of people say to me, wow, given your results, why didn't you form a biotech? And the answer is, well, because I care more about patients than profits. I really don't want to worry about sunk costs. If we find something doesn't work, we just drop it that day. We don't pursue it. I never want to worry about a shareholder. I want to worry about the patients. That's our whole goal here. So the 50 of us are communicating all the time. I mean, this morning I was talking to about 12 researchers ranging from Miami to San Francisco and Phoenix. We share experiments. We get together at least once a year, all of us, for a no-holds conference. And basically we just have one single wish, which is to find new therapies for ALS. So we've basically created a virtual pharmaceutical firm without investing the brick and mortar, and all the costs of marketing. We have a faculty of 50 now on our little virtual pharmaceutical firm, and it's been a terrific experience for all of us.
Wonderful. We love to see new ways of attacking this problem. Now, does this mean that you do not pursue FDA-approved trials or something different?
Well, that's been the great thing, is that the FDA has been fabulous with us. If we discover something, our goal is to go immediately, as soon as possible, to human clinical trials, because that seems to me to be the major stumbling block in translating new research discoveries at the lab bench to this patient bedside. So we've now, let's see, we've had two different trials approved by the FDA. The first one took us 5 to 6 weeks. The second one took us 4 days, which I think is a record. We're just finishing that trial up, and now we're moving towards a phase two. I think part of this is because the FDA, contrary to some rumor, not the bad guys. They just want to protect people and patients, particularly from hokey stuff, from things that can hurt their health or damage them. We give the FDA the information they need. Our clinical workers and researchers are top-notch. Again, our clinicians are really four centers now. Dr. Walter Bradley at the Miller School of Medicine, University of Miami, Dr. Robert Miller at the Forbes Norris ALS MND Clinic in San Francisco, Dr. Elijah Stommel, Department of Neurology at Dartmouth Medical School, and Dr. Todd Levine, Dr. David Saperstein at Phoenix Neurological Associates. And these guys are all really well-regarded in the research community, well-regarded by the FDA. And so, we are pursuing and have been granted licenses by the FDA to conduct human clinical trials. It's just that our trials are coming from a very different place. They're not coming from mouse models. They're coming from studies of indigenous people. And so far, we're pretty excited about the progress we've made.
Thank you. We will pause again to tell our listeners how to ask a question.
The phone number to call in is 516-590-0362, and push 1 on your phone so we know you have a question.
Thank you. So, Dr. Cox, once you formulated the BMA theory, how do you proceed to test that theory?
Well, maybe I can give you a little bit of sense of our first FDA approval of L-serine to test in human clinical trials. We discovered with our colleagues in Australia, Dr. Rachel Dunlop and Dr. Ken Rogers, that BMAA can be mistaken by our cell machinery as a normal amino acid and insert itself into proteins and cause them to misfold and tangle, to aggregate. In fact, ALS is considered a tangled disease, along with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, supranuclear palsy, Pick's disease, a half dozen others. And we got very interested in how this tangling is caused. We discovered together with our Australian colleagues that by increasing the amount of one of the normal dietary amino acids, L-serine, in cell culture that we could actually stop neuronal cells from dying and these proteins from misfolding. We then contacted Dr. Joy Godo, who's chair of the chemistry department at Cal State Fullerton. Dr. Godo, although she's a chemist, is an expert on studying fruit fly responses to toxic insult. She quickly confirmed these in vitro results with a fruit fly model. When exposed to BMAA, within 3 days, fruit flies start having inability to fly, gait paralysis. When we added L-serine to the fruit fly chow, they didn't have that problem, and we found that we could even rescue some of them up to 24 hours after hitting them with BMAA. So armed with that in vitro data and the in vivo fruit fly data, we went immediately to the FDA. Now, we sort of do everything backwards at our laboratory because the typical academic program is, first of all, you get the idea, then you write a grant, then you wait a year or two to get your grant approved, and then you do the research. And then after a year, you publish, and then after you publish, maybe you somehow find some way to work with a clinical researcher and move in the clinic. Here, we did everything backwards. We immediately took these results straight to the FDA, said, please approve our request to begin human clinical trials. FDA approved within a week. We brought in our team of clinical researchers, Dr. Todd Levine and Dr. David Saperstein at Phoenix Neurological Associates in Arizona, and then Dr. Robert Miller and his team at the Forbes Norris ALS MND Clinic. We began dosing patients with L-serine in different doses. As you know, a phase one trial is basically to confirm that that the drug does not harm patients or worsen their disease. We've just finished this trial now. We're working on the publication of this. The good news is that it really doesn't appear to us that there are any serious or significant complications to patients from taking orally L-serine. And we're now preparing a phase two trial. We're trying to raise $1.5 million to do a 60-patient trial to see if L-serine can slow the progression of ALS disease symptoms. And we're all pretty excited. I mean, we really won't know until it's been proven in a clinical setting that it works. But that led us to do some interesting primate trials in the island of St. Kitts.
Wow. Now, is L-serine an approved drug or is it a supplement? Tell us more about L-serine.
Well, what we decided to do is I wanted to see, I mean, I have some reservations about the mouse models and rodent models. I mean, my hat's off to all the great people that work on them, so this is in no way a critique of their work. But where our focus is on moving so quickly to human clinical trials, I wanted something that was closer to human beings to get a heads up on how L-serine might work. So we started studying vervets on the island of St. Kitts. St. Kitts is a Caribbean island. Vervets were introduced there from Africa maybe 100 years ago. They've gone wild. They don't belong on the island. There's 30 or 40,000. And so there's a couple of research colonies on St. Kitts. These are very nice places where, the animals are housed in groups and big enclosures. So it really feels more like a zoo than a research facility. The animals are happy. Wild vervets try break in there. It's sort of funny to see that. So we went through an institutional review board, raised the funds from our board of trustees in the John and Joseph P. Lewis Foundation because it's expensive to do primate trials. So we started supplementing the feeding of these vervets on an extended period. What we noticed in the village, and this is work done by Ralph Garrido and others at NIH, is that as villagers left these villages in Guam that had such a high rate of this ALS-like disease that they could move to California, be down there for 15 or 20 years, and then come down with the paralysis and muscle denervation characteristic of ALS, meaning that there's a long latency to this disease. So what we tried to do is compress into 140 days about 15 to 20 years of chamorro exposure to the toxin. So as each day the animals would be handed, we just give them a banana. Inside the banana would be placed a powdered test substance. It would either be BMAA or rice flour for a placebo or BMAA plus serine. And then we had a very low dose of BMAA. We did this for 140 days. We were astonished by the results, replicated the study, and we just published that at the end of January, you know, in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London, Series B. And we're pretty excited about the publication. What we found was that after 140 days of chronic dietary exposure to BMAA, that these animals started developing neuropathology that's strikingly similar to what the Chamorro people have in the villages. We also found that when we added L-serine to their diet, that that significantly reduced the amount of this neuropathology. So armed with that and our findings from the phase one trial that it's safe for ALS patients to take serine in oral doses up to 30 grams a day, we're now prepared the protocols for a phase two clinical trial on L-serine to determine if it can actually slow disease progression in ALS patients. There's been a few anecdotal reports of patients that claim that it's helped them or slowed their progression, but we really won't know until we, you know, see if it works under a really rigorous clinical setting, and that's what we've designed. So we're hopeful that as soon as we can raise the funds, that we can get permission from the FDA and launch this trial. And I have to sort of put a cautionary note here, which is that we totally support the FDA process. You know, and it's really important for us to know if it works or not in a clinical setting before we get everybody all enthused and excited, because we just at this point don't know. So please, I'm not encouraging patients to add L-serine or go out and buy anything else to take. What I am saying is that we really want to find out as soon as possible if this shows a benefit. And if it does, then, of course, we'll be pushing right to the FDA for preliminary approval. And if it doesn't, then we'll drop this and move on to the next drug candidate. So that's the way our research works. And it really doesn't matter if we can cure every fruit fly or mouse or monkey in the world unless it works in the clinic. So, again, our focus has been to accelerate human clinical trials as quickly as possible.
Now, do you recall the numbers from your primate research? Were all of the vervets who expand BMAA or were dosed with it, did they develop symptoms?
Well, that's a really good question, Seth. And the answer is none of the animals developed symptoms. What we found was neuropathology that would be preclinical, that would be consistent with chamorros who will get sick but haven't done so already. So our findings were based on neuropathology and not signs in terms of behavior. But what sort of astonished us, I guess, was that all of the BMAA-fed animals developed neuropathology, but those that we had supplemented their diet or with L-serine had a 50 to 80% reduction in that neuropathology. So we all feel very strongly that this is something we need to follow up quickly on now to see if we can see that if it works in the clinic in human beings or not. And we're ready to go as soon as we can raise the $1.5 million.
Thank you for that clarification. At this point, we will pause to take the question of an online listener.
Thank you.
We have a question from a caller ending in 6431. Go ahead, you're on the air with Dr. Cox.
Thank you so much. You can hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Cox, thank you so much. It is so exciting to hear about your work as a person who has an ALS relative. I just can't thank you enough for your collaboration across the globe with people concerned not about the bottom line profit, but about helping people. Thank you. Now, my question is, does ALS manifest itself the same way did it in Guam as it has in other places, as it does here in the U.S.? Is it the same nature?
That's a really good question. And the answer is the Guam disease is somewhat unique. What happened was in the aftermath of World War II, when the United States retook Guam from the Japanese who had controlled it, U.S. Army physicians started noticing these patients with ALS-like symptoms and started counting them up and realized their horror that, you know, it was 50 to 100 times the rate of ALS elsewhere. But the disease has some distinct differences in Guam than elsewhere. Sometimes the patients in Guam show symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Sometimes the patients show symptoms of Parkinson's. Some unfortunate individuals have symptoms of all three. So clinically, it was different. And neuropathologically, it was different, too, because the Chamorro people show in their brain tissues, those who have the disease, brain plaques and tangles that are quite characteristic of Alzheimer's disease, but which we typically don't see in abundance in ALS patients. And what we reported in our paper in the Royal Society of London in January was that we had found these brain tangles and plaques in the brains of these vervets that had been chronically exposed to, through their diet to BMAA. We're still continuing work with the Miami Brain Bank, looking now very carefully for neuropathology consistent with ALS, and we don't know yet, but we're excited to find out if that occurred.
Thank you. My final question would be, you say that you're in need of funding to go to the next step. Will this happen by huge grants, or is there any way individuals can participate in this? What will be helpful to you?
Right. Well, thank you very much. And again, Seth, let me say that my purpose here in participating in this call is not to raise funds. Look, we run a not-for-profit organization, and so when ALS patients come and see us or talk to us or phone, I tell them, we'll work for you. That's it. There's nobody else. I mean, I think there's very few people in the world who wake up every morning thinking about ALS other than ALS patients and their families, and we're there. So the message really here, Seth, for the listeners is one of hope, that there's a group of people in Wyoming that are augmented by 50 people around the world. We are all of us from a variety of disciplines, and we're very, very determined to keep pushing forward. That said, as a not-for-profit organization, we do we're supported about 40% of our funding comes from our board of directors, none of whom have ALS or ALS in their families, but they're just very public-spirited people. About 20% comes from research foundations, and the remainder from well-meaning individuals. Anybody that donates a dollar to us, I send them a letter every month to keep them up on the research. But so far, we've been very fortunate. We have a fairly small budget. We've been spending about $1.5 million a year, plus whatever it costs us for the clinical trials. But at this point, we need to do a clinical trial. I've been looking for $2.5 million for 120 patients. None of those funds would be used by us. They'd all go to just cover hospital costs and clinical costs of the trial. That's a bit daunting, so we've reduced it now to 65 patients for $1.5 million. And as soon as we can get these funds, we'll be able to go forward. And I'm quite hopeful that we can find this from private sources. Our research is so different from mainstream ALS research. Most of the mainstream researchers have been studying genetic determinants of ALS. And as you and your listeners probably know, about 8 to 10% of ALS patients have a family history, and about half of those have a identified mutation like SOD1 or TDP43 or FUS. Our focus is on sporadic cases where there's no family history, but we are outside not only sort of the mainstream research, we're outside of mainstream funding. And so we've been raising the funds on our own, and it's been just a wonderful thing. There's a family in Logan, Utah. Lee Badger was a beloved member of the Logan, Utah community who owned Lee's Marketplace, a chain of grocery stores. When he passed away from ALS, his family decided to fight it, so they started a golf tournament in Logan, Utah, and I think that'll be June 3rd this year. And everybody comes up and has a good time in the golf tournament in Logan called the ALS Challenge has been supporting our research now for 4 or 5 years. And there's just other people that do wonderful things to try help us out. But again, Seth, my intent was not to try raise money through this interview, but just to let people know, first of all, that there's hope. Secondly, that there's people that are thinking outside the box, approaching us from a very different angle. And third, that we've made some success now. We've really seen some real progress, particularly with the primate study and particularly with the phase one clinical study that's pushing us forward now to do a phase two study. Once we get the funding, I'm quite hopeful that we can finish that study within 12 months, and we'll know yes or no, can L-serine help slow the loss of muscle and neurons experienced by ALS people. I mean, my personal goal is to, I don't know if I can cure ALS, but I think we've got a shot at slowing it down, buying patients more time with their families and their loved ones, and buying more time for where they can stay functional. And my real dream would be to change the landscape of ALS so it can be managed as a chronic disease, much like multiple sclerosis is already. And I think that's possible, and I think that's within our grasp, and I'm optimistic, and I want to pursue every avenue I can to see if we can achieve that. And if we fail, well, we fail, but it's a great cause and one that we're fully invested in.
Thank you. Thank you, caller, for your question. Now, Dr. Cox, many of our listeners are unable to speak or call in over the phone. We have a number of online questions that Lori will read.
Thanks. We have a series of three questions from a listener that kind of go together. What does the L-serine treatment look like in humans? Like, what would the dosage be? What are the side effects that it may have? And how can an ALS diagnosis get involved in your clinical trial?
Well, let me start with the first one. L-serine is a common amino acid in our diet. It's rich in soybeans and soy products like edamame. It's rich in sweet potatoes and pork and eggs, bacon. So we're already getting, on average, about 3.5 grams of L-serine from all forms of our diet. That would be average for Americans. We have, in our phase one trial, have orally dosed patients up to 30 grams per day and doing it twice a day. We're still working on the manuscript. We want to publish this and, of course, take it through peer review, but the preliminary results suggest that patients tolerate that well. Side effects that we've noticed in patients include bloating, nausea in a couple of patients. I cannot recommend a dosage because I don't know, and furthermore, it's not been approved by the FDA. So, again, my advice is to you know, just stay tight till we can find out if it's working or not, because I don't want to do anything to suggest any practice that people would adopt that has no efficacy. For the phase two trial, if we can get the funding quickly and get it approved quickly, and I'm optimistic that maybe we can do both of these things, the trial will occur at a couple of centers. I think it will occur at Dartmouth Medical School, occur at the Forbes Norris ALS Clinic in San Francisco, and occur at Phoenix Neurological Associates and a couple of others. So basically my best advice is to just stay in close touch with your physician, and as these opportunities become available, I'm sure your physician will let you know. And the other place you can look for news is we have a website, ethnomedicine.org, which is ethnomedicine.org. People are happy to work there. We always are delighted to welcome ALS patients. Our laboratory in Jackson Hole, we're just off the town square, opposite the elementary school. Although we can't advise people on medical conditions because we're all PhDs there, we're not MDs, we delight in sharing our research with patients. We've had a number come up and see us, and we're not in a position to diagnose or prescribe. But we do have some really heavy hitter neurologists in. I mean, Dr. Walter Bradley is sort of like Yoda in terms of the ALS community. I mean, he's been awarded as the top ALS clinician researcher. Dr. Robert Miller in San Francisco, same thing. It's sort of like having Yoda and Obi-Wan Kenobi on the team here. Dr. Miller's clinic in San Francisco is so fabulous. And what's really impressed me is the deep respect and dignity they accord to patients. And so we've got the right team. We've got an unusual approach and an unusual idea, but we have some promising preliminary results, and our goal is to see if we can see if they work in the clinic or not, and we aim to do so in a very rapid fashion.
Wonderful. And in the meantime, we should not shy away from bacon and eggs for breakfast, correct?
Well, any guilt that you feel on eating bacon and eggs, you are hereby resolved of. I mean, in my own life, I've changed my diet. I'm eating a lot more edamame now. I buy these little packets that I throw in the microwave. You get them in the frozen vegetable section, and I eat them for breakfast. I eat them for lunch. So I'm jacking up my own L-serine content. And again, if it doesn't pan out in the clinic, well, so be it. But it would be so wonderful if it works, because this is a relatively non-toxic treatment, and we just love to know if it can help people or not.
Excellent. Thank you for that removal of my guilt. Now, we would like to talk briefly about, you mentioned an upcoming trial, but what other ways will your research progress? Is that solely through the trial?
Well, I have pretty deep feelings about ALS, and I'm finding, you know, we put pictures of patients up in our laboratory. My team is so amazing. You know, we went out canoeing. We took one day off one year, an afternoon, went canoeing on the Snake River, bring the canoes back. And I asked Dr. James Metcalf, my key cyanobacterial specialist, I said, well, can I take you back to your home? And he said, well, no, could you drop me in the lab? I said, why? And he said, well, I said, it's 10 p.m. He said, well, I still think I have time to make one more experiment. So that's the sort of spirit here, is that there's one more experiment. That being said, I can't speak for patients and their families, but it seems to me that if I were a patient, I would take heart in people trying all sorts of different approaches to ALS. The current approach, again, the last drug for ALS came out in 1994. I mean, that's, 22 years ago? That's just outrageous. I'm really frustrated by this. I think there should be as many different approaches as possible, all carefully screened by the FDA and under rigorous clinical conditions. And the hope is that one of those would yield a new drug, a new treatment that could be of benefit to patients. And so I would like to see, obviously, more approaches rather than narrower and more highly focused approaches. Again, I think everybody in the ALS community is working very hard, and there's been some spectacular advances made in understanding the genetic basis of familial ALS. But as far as I'm aware, our consortium are the only groups working on environmental triggers. And yet, you know, the teams we have, I mean, William Camus, neurology at University of Montpellier, Christian Conradi at the Karolinska Institute, I think we've got a shot. I don't know how big a shot it is, but we've got a chance, and we're going to take that shot. And the way to take the shot is to complete a phase two clinical trial to see if it's efficacious in slowing progression of disease symptoms in ALS patients.
Excellent. We have one final question for you, but before we go and ask that, I'll have Lori tell our listeners about our next episode.
Our next episode for ALS Crowd Radio will be Wednesday, May 4th at 11 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time with Dr. Richard Bedlack speaking about ALS reversals.
Thank you, Lori. Now, Dr. Cox, we've covered a lot of ground in this hour, but and touched on how we can get involved and support your research. But from your perspective, what is the greatest opportunity in ALS for people who care to get involved?
You know, that's such an interesting question. One thing I've really felt is that it's a real gift for me to have been able to meet such wonderful patients. There's something special about ALS patients, not just that they're facing a devastating disease, but they tend to be very nice people. And what I've noticed is that the patients that get involved in clinical trials do better, even if the drug doesn't work, and that's because they're under observation all the time by physicians. People that are very proactive in fighting it seem to do better. And you know, again, I would encourage your listeners to go onto our website at ethnomedicine.org. There's a short film clip there. They can get an idea of our research and research papers. And I guess what I really want to say is thank you, because we've received so many encouraging notes and messages from ALS patients and their families, and it's been a very deeply moving experience for me to get involved in this community. And I just, my prayer is that something that we do in Wyoming with our colleagues will turn to benefit for ALS patients, and if that happens, we'd be delighted.
Thank you. And thank you for your time, Dr. Cox. It's an honor to speak with you, and please relay to your staff our gratitude for their work and sacrifice on our behalf.
I'll be pleased to do that, Seth. Thank you.
All right. And thank you, listeners. This has been a great episode. Please tune in to the next episode. Thank you again to Dr. Paul Cox of Jackson Hole, Wyoming.